Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for coming to the Lowy Institute this afternoon to join me for my conversation with Jane Perlez, the Bureau Chief of the New York Times from Beijing. The topic for today's conversation is about China's growing role in world affairs, what that looks like from the Beijing perspective, what it looks like from the inside. So Jane's been in Beijing as the head of the New York Times, as the Bureau Chief, since 2012. She focuses mostly on China's foreign policy, particularly its relations with the United States and its Asian neighbours. But this is, you know, on the back of a pretty exciting career in a lot of other very interesting places. So great to have a kind of comparative perspective. Some people I know are so steeped in China they can't see anything else in the world. But it's great that you can balance that. So Jane's first foreign assignment for the New York Times was in East Africa, covering civil conflict and famine. She served as bureau chief in Kenya, Poland, Austria, Indonesia, and Pakistan, and was a member of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2009 for reporting in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So probably fair to say she knows some stuff about some stuff. So we want to talk today about China's growing role. How does the world look from Beijing? Is Xi Jinping strategically navigating this, or are the Chinese elite opportunistically just grabbing on to whatever comes along, which seems to be a fair few things at the moment for them? So I want to start, though, just by asking, what's it like being in Beijing now compared to some of the places you've been at for the New York Times in the past?
Well, first of all, I'd sort of like to thank the Lowy Institute for having me. It really does a wonderful job of bringing issues of the day to the forefront, and I think this is really quite a gathering, so thank you, everybody, for coming. I don't know that I've got anything to say that you don't already know, but it's nice to see some Australian faces again. I am a graduate of Sydney University, so I don't know that this is my hometown. New York really is, but I feel very much at home here, so thanks for coming. Now, China. Yes, there is a strategy, I think, and it's one that you're all familiar with, which is, particularly since Xi Jinping came to power, is to make China a preeminent power. And I think he is very determined. Unlike his immediate predecessors, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, he's not conflict-averse. By that I don't mean that he wants war, we don't know about that yet, but he's not averse to putting China into positions where other countries disagree. Witness the South China Sea, witness the protectionist policies, economic policies that American business doesn't like. Those are just two small examples. And I think also his most immediate goal is to knit Southeast Asia to China and bring Southeast Asia into China's orbit. And he's doing a pretty fast job with that. Laos and Cambodia are already firmly in China's pocket. Thailand and Myanmar are moving that way faster than the United States seems to want to recognize. Malaysia's not doing too badly from the Chinese point of view, and who knows what's going to happen after the Lee family leaves Singapore. And then there's Australia sitting down here, which is not formally part of Southeast Asia, but who knows, maybe that's the last and most important trophy. I think that Xi Jinping is very determined at a critical time in world affairs when the EU is in disarray, when the United States is under Trump all about America first, and he can take advantage of this in lots of ways. So while Trump is withdrawing from TPP, withdrawing from the climate change accord, and not taking NATO as seriously as he should, and leaving EU to squabble among themselves, China can take advantage of this in many ways. So, for example, in the G20 coming up this week, Chinese diplomats and officials have told the EU, will you be the ones who carry the water for us on climate change? We want you to tell the Americans to keep to the climate change accord. We want the United States to be with the climate change accord, but we'd like you to do the talking to the United States about this. So this is kind of an interesting diplomatic, position, and I think it shows that the Chinese want to get their ways in many direct and indirect ways.
And so you mentioned that you think that China wants to be a preeminent power. Are you talking regionally as well as globally?
Well, I know you and I disagree slightly on this. Of course, their immediate goal is a regional, but I do think all the pointers are to wanting to become a preeminent global power, particularly economically. I'm not saying that they want to repeat the American model of having military alliances all around the world. Probably not, although there are some advocates in Beijing, as you know, who do think that China should have formal alliances. And they are building ports in interesting places like Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Djibouti, which can easily be transformed from civilian ports to military ones.
Right. So China, in your opinion, has a strategy. Xi Jinping is determined to pursue it. And as you said, he's got the personality different from his predecessors and probably the capabilities to do that if he wants to. How do you think it's going so far? Do you think that there's a lot of challenges in Xi's path? Or
I think he's having a pretty good time so far, pretty easy path so far. Trump is not showing any leadership at all. The EU is in disarray, as I mentioned. He can stand up at Davos and say, I'm a global leader, when in fact he isn't doing anything to promote the kind of global leadership that people have expected for the last 70 years. He can say, I am, but he doesn't have to say, I will. So it's early days yet. It's only 6 months in since Trump came to power. But I think so far he's doing pretty well. So let's take North Korea, which you and I discussed. It's quite interesting. When Xi Jinping came to Florida in April, Trump said to him, I'm sort of trying to visualize, I've often tried to visualize this. I don't know whether I was sitting on a sofa in that ornate living room or across a table or where they were sitting, but Trump said to Xi, well, half my staff tells me that you control North Korea, and the other half tell me that you don't control North Korea. And Xi Jinping said something like, well, Donald, I'm not sure whether he said Donald, but well, Mr. President, it's not quite like that, but it is like this. I don't have any control politically. I can't do anything with that upstart Kim Jong-un, but I do have some control over the economy. And so that led to apparently a 3 to 4 hour conversation where Xi Jinping explained the nuts and bolts of China's relationship with Korea over many, many centuries, in which the President of the United States said, oh, gosh, it's more complicated than I thought. Really, really complicated. So let's give China the benefit of the doubt. Let's ask China to crack down on North Korea economically. They say they've got control. So Donald came out and said, after the meeting, well, you know, China's going to crack down on North Korea, and that way we're going to solve the nuclear problem. And, you know, a few days later, Trump calls Xi and says, how's it going? And we don't know what the other end said. And then about 2 weeks later, Trump called again and said, how's it going?
Are we there yet?
And by this stage, people were coming to Washington, you know, Xi's minions from think tanks and other places were coming to Washington saying, you know, the President of the United States should understand that the President of China is not his middle management. The President of China doesn't work as a manager at the Trump organization. And, you know, the President of China is getting a bit tired of this. But anyway, that's all a way of saying that China was asked to do this by Obama. This is an old trick by past American administrations to get China to put the squeeze on North Korea so that they'll behave on their nuclear weapons. And it didn't work then, and it hasn't worked now. So finally, you know, 10 days ago, Trump woke up and said, oh my God, you know, my buddy Xi hasn't done anything on this North Korea question, so the honeymoon's over. And last week, the United States imposed what are called secondary sanctions on a bank called the Dandong Bank, which is services a lot of North Korea's money laundering needs. Of course, those who think that sanctions are going to work and are going to sort of get rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons, a position I don't quite agree with, but those who believe in sanctions think this is a great move. Oh my God, this is the start of China really putting the screws on, and this means that this bank in a remote northeast part of China is not going to be able to participate in the international banking system, and this is going to, you know, shortchange North Korea with its money laundering activities. Well, you know, maybe, but it's not going to curb the problem with the nuclear weapons. And so we're still in the same position that we've been in for the last dozen years on North Korea. And China, and that's because China will not, under Xi Jinping, get off its basic policy, which is we need the North. North Korea is a buffer against, as everybody here knows, we need it as a buffer against the possibility of a united Korea, which would be under the possible domination of American troops. And although there are people who say that there is a debate within the Chinese establishment on North Korea, there may be, but Xi Jinping's in charge, and he seems to very much adhere to the tried and true policy of keeping North Korea where it is, and their proposal of a freeze for a freeze, yeah, which is a freeze of the North's weapons in exchange for the United States limiting or cutting back its military exercises in with South Korea as a non-starter. Then the Americans are never going to agree to limiting their exercises, weakens their military position in the region. It's just so. And the North Koreans are not going to agree to denuclearization. They've said this over and over and over again. So that's where we are.
Yes.
And I just want to say that Xi has stood his ground and will stand his ground.
Right, because it goes back to a much deeper question about what's important for the CCP legitimacy, Xi's ongoing power, and that persecution complex. In which you must, it's better to have North Korea there as a buffer against the US than have the US at your door, even if that means not having a nuclear state next door, which is an interesting logic. Now, I want to talk about the Belt and Road Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
That's big and exciting. So talking about China's strategy, as you mentioned, where do you think the Belt and Road Initiative or the One Belt, One Road fits into that strategy?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, some people call it Belt and Road, China's sort of effort at commerce, global commerce on China's terms. Basically, this is a program that Xi announced back in 2013, and just by good planning or happenstance, I happened to be there in Astana, Kazakhstan, when he announced what sounded like a very modest idea of knitting Central Asia together with China, whereby China would pay for or give loans for oil pipelines and other energy infrastructure that would knit the two, China and Central Asia, together. But as with almost everything in China, it's gotten bigger and faster and grander, faster than we expected. And so by now, this modest program of 2013 is supposed to span 60 countries, and they're going to spend, they say, $1 trillion. So this is an effort to build ports, bridges, energy pipelines in Africa, Europe, Asia, and to knit the world closer into China. It's a sort of a way of cementing its supply chain in a way. I was in Laos a couple of months ago, and this is neighboring country, of course, and it's a good example. They're building a rail line from southern China down to Vientiane, which will then go across to Thailand and to the sea. Does Laos really need this train line? No. It's a vastly agricultural country. It would be nice if they had some better transport, but they don't need this very elaborate train line that's being drilled through countless mountains and will show off China's great engineering feat. No, they don't really need it. Does China need it? Yes. We'll see how fast it goes, though. As you know, Australia has said no to the Belt and Road Initiative because what it entails in most countries is bringing Chinese workers into the country. It also entails bringing China's overcapacity of steel, cement, and other goods into the country, which may be fine for Laos, but isn't so good for places like Australia. India has said no because China wants to build a road through Kashmir, Pakistan-controlled Kashmir, which India is opposed to, and the Europeans have shown some resistance as well. But that being said, that didn't stop many leaders and foreign ministers turning up in Beijing a couple of months ago for a Belt and Road conference where Xi could strut his stuff and where Putin was quite front and center, and even the United States upgraded its presence from, you know, the son of the coming ambassador to the head guy on the NSC. So I think it's a pretty formidable program. One thing to watch for is how many countries that sign up for it, though, will be left holding the bag. The Chinese are not giving this away. They're lending money, and people and countries will have to pay back. And so it's up to the countries to negotiate good terms. Laos negotiated better terms than it had in the beginning. So that will be something to watch for.
And do you think that Australia was right not to sign a memorandum of agreement?
Yes, I think so. From Australia's point of view, why would Australia want Chinese workers coming in and building whatever it is that's on offer? I'm not quite sure if there was any concrete proposal. Also, I think by signing onto Belt and Road, you are signing into a kind of political understanding with China. So you can see, for example, with Greece, the port in Piraeus, which was built and started operating a couple of years ago, was before the formal announcement of Belt and Road, but it's now considered to be part of the Belt and Road program. And we saw that China got its payback from Greece just 10 days ago when Greece objected to the European Union taking part in a discussion on human rights in China. So, yeah, there are political obligations that come with it. I mean, it's a bit like America's Marshall Plan after World War II, but without the concomitant military arrangements that were understood to go with the Marshall Plan. At least they're not up front yet.
Mm. The Belt and Road Initiative is about China's strategy going outwards. In terms of what's happening domestically in China, can you tell us a bit about the Made in China 2025 initiative, what that means for this?
I find this initiative one of the most interesting aspects of China at the moment. And I'm not sure, I don't follow the Australian press too closely, I'm not sure if it's that well known here, is
it? I'd say not, no.
Made in China 2025 is basically a blueprint for how China is going to be the preeminent smart manufacturer in the world. It's a public document. It's on the web. You can look it up and you can read it. It's a blueprint for how they're going to do this and what they hope to achieve. So they hope to have more than 80% of renewable energy, producing more than 80% of renewable energy goods by 2025, more than 70% of industrial robots. They have goals for driverless cars. They have goals for 40% of mobile phone chips by 2025. And the interesting thing is, how are they going to do this? Well, we've seen already how they're going to do this. They bought Germany's biggest industrial robotic company last year, KUKA, for $7 billion. They're making stealth investments in Silicon Valley into startups for smart technology and much and other more public acquisitions. China has introduced a suite of of domestic laws that make it harder for foreign companies in China to operate make it more difficult for foreign tech companies to operate in China. Very high scrutiny of source code, national security laws, other laws that make it difficult to comply with. And more foreign tech companies that come into China will have to agree to joint ventures, and to be a part of a joint venture, you will be obliged to give up your IP. So there's a great deal of worry among some American businesses about this, but there's not a united front among American businesses about this. And so far, the Trump administration has kind of taken a hands-off attitude to it, because Wilbur Ross and the trade guys seem to be more interested in soya beans and beef. But one could argue that the future of of American tech in China is more important than supplying beef and soya beans. When you think about it, the United States and Western countries provided China with much of its tech 20 years, 15 years ago, because they didn't have any. And now they're supplying less and less. And talking about things getting faster and faster in China, I'd say 18 months ago in Washington, people would say, oh, American tech companies have got another decade to go in China. Now they're saying 3.5 to 5 years before they're regulated out of China. This is pretty scary. So I think that people should take big interest in Made in China 2025 because it's protectionist, and it affects the big industrial countries of the world, which in turn affects Australia.
And do you think, in terms of the innovation angle of Made in China 2025, what do you think about the way in which the kind of education system works in China and the capacity for the critical thought that might be required for innovation?
Yeah, good point. I mean, there are Chinese, I guess you'd call them Chinese reformers, who are skeptical that the goals of China, Made in China 2025, can be reached for just the reason that you mentioned, that it's too top-down, that it doesn't give enough air and space to individualism, to innovation, and they think, and they also think that the top bosses will probably could choose the wrong industries which to try and make a gambit for. Having said that, Kai-Fu Lee, who's a very interesting character in Beijing, who runs a big innovation company, has said that he thinks that China will do very well with driverless cars, for example, because China tends to regulate much less in the early going than the United States. So I think this is going to be interesting to see where it comes out. And we don't have that much time. I mean, it's just 7 years away. Their target's just 7 years away.
Right. Okay, so moving away from this innovation, wanted to get a bit of your sense, going back into politics, the 19th Party Congress coming up not so far away later this year. And what's it like on the ground in Beijing at the moment? I mean, before every party congress, there's always tightening up of some sort. How's the feeling there at the moment in the lead up to this one?
Well, it's not really my bag, but I can say that people who do follow this say that you can't predict the new membership of the standing committee until they walk out on the stage, that there can be really dramatic last-minute changes. So obviously there's a huge amount of anticipation. But in ways, I think there's not that much anticipation because Xi is such a strong boss that what he says goes, And so, of course, the political infighting is fascinating. But is it really going to make that much difference? So what's the political infighting?
Yeah, what's the gossip?
So the question is, will Wang Qishan, who's an anti-corruption czar, will he, A, stay on, and B, will he become prime minister? Well, as you may have heard, there's a lot of noise from outside China trying to affect this. There's this character called Guo Wengui, who sits in the Sherry Netherlands on Fifth Avenue in New York, from his zillion-dollar apartment, which, by the way, carries a $58,000 a month maintenance. He's not...
Maintenance.
Maintenance, $58,000 a month maintenance. So Gore sits up there and he writes the equivalent of tweets. Of course, Twitter's banned in China, but on social media in China, he is attacking Wang Qishan, the anti-corruption czar. And so the question is, will his beating up of Wang Qishan work? Will he rise or not? It's very hard to tell. One of Gore's allegations is that Wang Qishan's wife has an American passport. So needless to say, journalists are scurrying around all over the United States, A, trying to find the wife, and B, trying to find if she has an American passport. Of course, passport information, I don't know what it's like here, but passport information in the United States is almost like your tax returns. I mean, thank God tax returns are protected. But, you know, passport information is so hidden under privacy laws that it's really, really, really difficult to find out. But if Wang Qishan's wife is found to have an American passport, I'd say that's curtains for Wang Qishan. The other thing that's influencing the Party Congress is this guy, Xiao Jianhua, who was arrested in the Four Seasons Hotel in Hong Kong in January. He was taken out the front door at 4 a.m. with a bag over his head and in a wheelchair. This was the guy who's basically been the personal banker for some of the top characters in the Chinese government for the last 4 or 5 or 6 years. Apparently, he flew too close to the sun. We don't know quite exactly what his misdoings were, but there are rumors that he got hold of state assets in ways that he shouldn't have been. So he was taken out of the Four Seasons and sent back to China, where he is no doubt under detention and being questioned very closely. So who knows what he's going to cough up and whether that will influence the 19th Party Congress.
Any more thoughts? When I was there recently, people were talking a lot about Li Keqiang and what his potential roles might be. Still endless speculation there?
Endless speculation. I mean, I think the favorite is that he'll go to the National Party Congress and Wang Qishan will step in and be prime minister. But Wang Qishan's well into his 70s, so he's not only got the hurdle of the corruption charges being flung at him from the Sherry Netherlands in New York, but he's also got the age barrier.
Right, but I mean, that could be overturned without too much problem by Xi Jinping.
Probably.
Yeah. And how are things in terms of just normal daily life for people living in China in terms of access to information, freedom of speech in the lead up to that party congress?
Actually, I thought you were going to say how's daily life for people in China per se, and I think I'll just make a note and say that in many ways it's never been better. I mean, I'm just constantly astonished, and visitors who come to Beijing are constantly astonished by the consumer-driven life and what's available and what people can buy with their salaries. And e-commerce has changed the face of the way people think about their daily lives, I really think. And even in the 5 years since I've been there, it's just fundamentally changed everything. So on the surface, people are pretty gratified that life is good. It's better than it's ever been for many people. And I'm not talking just about Beijing, but when you go to second and third tier cities, you see a lot of consumerism, a lot of people buying a lot of stuff. In terms of political freedoms, well, they get less and less. Social media is constantly under attack. As you know, Google, Twitter, and Facebook are blocked. For what it's worth, the New York Times is blocked, the Wall Street Journal is blocked, the Financial Times is blocked. The only Western big Western media company that's not blocked is Bloomberg, and that's because they did a deal with their business machines. It's getting harder and harder for ordinary people to get information about their own government, about what's going on in China, or about anything overseas. So the latest trick is that VPNs, I don't know if people here know what VPNs are, virtual private network, they're basically, it's basically a tool that uses encryption to bust through the Chinese firewall on the internet. The government is now going after these devices, which will make it difficult for Chinese people to access the New York Times, among other things, and to get access to Google and so forth. I think that's not only because of the lead up to the 19th Party Congress, but because it's Xi Jinping and the party's goal to keep the Communist Party preeminent at all costs. I mean, that's the basic goal. And any criticism of the party is verboten, increasingly so. So on that note, it's symbolic that it should be happening just on the eve of the 19th Party Congress, but Liu Xiaobo, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010, I believe, was in prison just before he won the prize and has been in prison ever since, was due to get out next year. It was announced by the government 10 days ago that he had untreatable liver cancer, and he has been put in a so-called civilian hospital, but he's still under armed guard. I mean, this is some kind of... It's not a release from prison. He's still under the prison system, but he's in a civilian hospital. And it's really, really disturbing to think that this government knew that this man had liver cancer for we don't know how long, but they release him just at the moment when he's obviously on his last legs and can't be treated. And there are pictures going around the Chinese web, which are very quickly deleted, but you can see them in the last few days, of him sitting in hospital being fed by a hospital attendant, looking very weak indeed.
And what do you make of those videos that have also come out publicly and remain up, of him being cared for and treated and the highest medical attention being given to him?
I regard it as the lowest common denominator of propaganda.
And I understand that Liu Xiaobo wants to be treated overseas.
Well, it's not entirely clear. I mean... there have been stories to that effect. It's very hard to get information on this. This has basically happened since I've been in Australia, but from what I can see, people who say they're close to the family are putting out different stories. Mm. I do know that Chinese officials briefed European Union diplomats in China last week and said that he could not be moved from China, that he was too ill to be moved. Now, whether he's too ill or they don't want him moved, I can't speak to that, but it's a very disturbing and frankly disgusting episode.
Yeah, that is. It's hard to segue into something else on that, but we've just got a couple more minutes before we go into our open discussion. Sure. And I just wanted just very quickly to get your sense of what the perspectives are in Beijing of the handover anniversary of Hong Kong and Xi Jinping's tremendously triumphant tour of Hong Kong. What's that like from within Beijing?
You know, the propaganda is very intense on Hong Kong.
I'm shocked and amazed.
Hong Kong is part of China, no questions asked, period. And when the protests occurred a couple of years ago, they were undercovered, to say the least. Hardly any mention of them. That being said, as you and I talked about earlier, I'm not quite sure why people are surprised, why outsiders are surprised. Like everything, as I've just mentioned, everything with China goes faster and quicker than you expected. So the period of Hong Kong's grace is slipping away much quicker than many people might have anticipated. But honestly, what do people anticipate? What do people expect? I mean, it's China's.
All right. And on that note, I shall open the floor to questions and answers. If you could just put your hand up and we'll send the microphone around. And if you could just let us know your name and affiliation, that would be terrific. The gentleman in here, please.
Thanks very much. There are so many wonderful topics to discuss, but my name is Jeff Miller from the Institute of International Affairs. Could I just go back to the North Korean issue that you mentioned? By coincidence, just today in the Australian newspaper, there's a long article by a very well-known Australian correspondent, Rowan Callick, who's just been up on the border.
I read it.
And his article describes a great shutdown of trade between China and North Korea, saying that the bridge, which used to be fully crowded with trucks 24/7, is now absolutely vacant and so on. And I wonder if you could just comment on that. Is that a piece of deception? Is it true? If it was true, of course, it would seem to indicate that the Chinese are in fact making an effort to have an impact on the North.
Well, the first thing I'd say is I'm not sure that you can really judge the amount of trade between China and North Korea by what goes over that rusted old bridge. Second point is, I think that the Chinese have, since the Mar-a-Lago summit, dialed back a bit on fuel supplies, but just a bit. It's impossible to verify any of this stuff. Reuters had a really good story last week saying that CNPC had shut off its diesel supplies. I suspect it's true, but I'm not sure what that means for the whole economy. And does that really affect the nuclear program is a question. Mm. I've been up to that area in Dandong. I was up there a couple of months ago, I was with my Chinese researcher, and it was quite one of the interesting things of my job is to travel around the country some and be with Chinese researchers whose eyes are just so opened by what happens when we go as New York Times correspondents. So in Dandong, we were followed at one point by five undercover security cars. And he said to me, Jane, why are they wasting all this money on us? So from that trip a couple of months ago, we did learn they are inspecting trucks that go from Dandong over into North Korea a bit more severely. We are in touch with some traders who say that they can't sell big machinery as easily as they could. They can't send that over the bridge as easily as they could because that could be presumably used in some kind of military capacity. So I think there is some tweaking around the edges, but I wouldn't call it a fundamental shift. And certainly they're not squeezing the economy really hard. Otherwise, if they were, we'd hear from it pretty soon from Pyongyang.
My name is Jim Deminx. My question to Jane is, you referred to the work that China is doing diplomatically in the immediate Asian Pacific region, yet there are still some countries there that seem to be resistant, including Indonesia, Vietnam, Singapore, India. Do you see that they're going to go with the flow eventually?
India not. Indonesia probably not. Vietnam, it was very interesting. 10 days ago, the vice chairman of the Central Military Commission was in Vietnam for a meeting which was supposed to conclude with a celebration of the anniversary of the 1979 border war. And there was, shall we say, not a meeting of the minds on a drilling operation in the South China Sea, and he left, and there was no celebration of the anniversary. So Vietnam is putting up some resistance as well. But all in all, I'm not sure that that's sufficient weight to counter what else is going on. I was just in Myanmar, for example, And it's quite extraordinary. I mean, here's a country that Obama worked so hard to bring into the American column. And the American political class was so interested in Aung San Suu Kyi as a beacon of democracy. Well, it turns out that Aung San Suu Kyi is actually quite a pragmatist. And she herself says she's not the beacon of democracy and human rights that she's advertised to be. And she's very determined to have good relations with China, which is sensible, of course, because they're neighbors. But what's extraordinary about it is that China, which advertises itself on not interfering in other people's affairs, is taking a very active part in trying to broker the long-standing civil wars, basically, between the warring armed groups in the north. And so about 3 weeks ago, there was a meeting in Naypyidaw between the seven northern warring groups. And guess who brought the northern warring groups to Naypyidaw? A very senior Chinese diplomat who's been assigned to try and work out arrangements between these warring groups who have traditionally been backed by China and the government of Myanmar. So they are trying very hard on the diplomatic front, and at the same time, they have a Belt and Road initiative at Chaipu on the coast with the Bay of Bengal, where CITIC, the big construction company, is basically the sole bidder to build a port there. They'll take 85% control, and that port is it's being built on a deep sea area, which will give very great access to oil tankers. That's the official reason, but can easily be switched to a military port, as I mentioned earlier. So in answer to your question, yes, there's a lot of there are countries that stand up to China, but I'm not sure that overall it's going to make a big difference in the long, long run. Monsieur at the back.
Thanks, Meriden. Aaron Conley from the Institute. I was just wondering, Jane, if you could speak a little bit about the relationship with South Korea, and in particular what we've seen over the last few months with regard to China's economic pressure on South Korea to try and convince it not to deploy this high-altitude air defense system. Is China taking the lesson that their economic coercion has not worked in this case, and perhaps they need to tweak that strategy? Or do they believe that it'll work eventually and that they can apply that strategy to other countries as well?
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up. I mean, there's no sign of Xi Jinping giving in at all on this economic pressure, not one ounce of giving in. I mean, there was some feeling that when Moon came in, because he was more aligned to the Chinese point of view on North Korea, that Xi Jinping might relent a bit. But the boycott of the Lotte company is still, I mean, I think they've tweaked it a little tiny bit, but it's still pretty much in force. And the Chinese are still bearing down very, very hard on opposition to THAAD, at least the government is. And it's quite extraordinary in a way when you think about it, because China's got bad relations with North Korea, actually. Relations with North aren't too good, even though they continue to support it economically. And its relations with South Korea are pretty poisonous, too. So quite where this leads is not clear, it seems to me. I thought the visit of Moon to Washington in the last couple of days was quite interesting. I haven't heard the inside skinny on it. Superficially, it seems as though Trump behave pretty well, except for one line about how the FTA needed to be reformed, but that's pretty predictable. But I think both sides went out of their way to sort of paper over the differences. At the same time, I think the people in Beijing were probably sitting there and thinking, this alliance isn't going so well, and they're just going to wait it out. They're just going to wait and wait and wait and try and split that alliance apart. That was the goal when Xi Jinping went to Seoul in 2014 to cozy up to Mrs. Park. I mean, it was clear as daylight, Xi Jinping trying to rattle that alliance. And that's they'll just keep at it. And I think they'll keep at it by keeping on the screws on the economic coercion. Why not, from their point of view?
And do you think, I mean, from Beijing, do you think that there's any difference between the kind of official government position and the everyday people's position on? Because, I mean, a little while ago, South Korea was anathema, and social media was covered with Chinese people being very angry about it. But that seems to have really died down. Maybe that's just because something else, they can be angry about something else now. But it does seem like that.
You mean they were angry because they couldn't watch their TV shows, and they were angry because they couldn't get their South Korean
goodies?
Yeah. Cosmetics.
No, I mean they were angry at South Korea. There was talk about not going on holiday there, and the boycott of Lotte. But it seems like the people's feeling has died down a bit, but the government is still.
Oh, the people's feelings have died down a bit because propaganda works.
Right.
Simple as that.
Right. Okay. But the government's still.
Hard
on the same position.
Hard.
Great. Well, not great. Can I get this down here?
Japan seems to be very poorly positioned at the moment. It's economically on the decline, and it's very dependent on the United States, and it's going to be have China to the north and China allies to the south of it. How do you see the long-term outlook for Japan?
Well, that's also interesting. You know, Yang Jiechi, the Xi Jinping's top diplomat, he's a state counselor, was in Tokyo about a month ago and spent 5 hours with his counterpart in Tokyo, which is unheard of given the sour relations of the last few years. So I think that there's actually a little bit of a rapprochement going on between China and Japan. I think China is taking advantage of every place they can. They see Trump, you know, withdrawing, screwing up the American alliances. So China's going to take advantage wherever it can, including in Japan. They see that, you know, okay, Abe and Trump got on fine at Mar-a-Lago and they played golf and so forth. But Abe's got to be nervous about this unpredictable man in the White House. And so China's beginning to move in. There was supposed to be a meeting between Xi and Abe at the G20 at the end of this week. I'm not sure if it's still on, but even if it isn't, I think that they'll make nice to each other for the next little while. And Japan's not in a strong position economically, but they'll make it up a little bit to China, just enough to take the edge off in the short term. Long term, I'll leave that one to you.
There's a question in the second back.
Thanks. I just had a question on capital.
Sorry, could you just...
My name is Emily Johnson, and I had a question on capital controls. We've seen probably over the past year and a half, the government really start to impose capital restrictions on individuals and institutions. And in my experience at my former job, I could see that these work to varying degrees with individuals finding ways around these restrictions. And for certainly an economy like Australia, particularly housing, that benefits a lot from foreign investment, do you get the sense on the ground that these restrictions are actually having any impact on people's ability to get money out of China?
Yes, I do. I do. Ordinary people in particular. It's not really my field, but I think ordinary people have to go to much greater lengths to get money out. And certain loopholes that were available in Hong Kong that you probably know more about than I do are no longer available. And I think on the big corporation level, it's probably, you know, who's in favor may have better time getting money out, and those who are not in favor may be more penalized. The problem with Ang Bang, the big insurance company, could be rooted in the government being uneasy with the amount of money that they were taking out of the country for foreign purchases. This is not exactly clear why Wu, the head of Ang Bang, is being detained, but that could be one of the reasons. I would say that capital controls are more likely to stay than not.
Yeah, Peter Green. China's relationship with Russia, how's that going?
Well, they put up a good show, but I think that they're such unequal countries at the moment. You know, Russia's almost in I shouldn't say beggar state, but in a pretty bad state financially, that it's hard to see that Xi Jinping would take Russia seriously as an equal or as a reliable ally. I think he's kind of a convenient tool to use to tell the West, ha, you know, here we are, but I wouldn't take it too seriously.
We had a question there from...
John Edwards from the Lowy Institute.
Oh, John Edwards.
The one
Jane,
only.
what's it like working as a reporter in Beijing compared to your other posts? We often hear from senior US officials, they actually have no access to the Chinese leadership. What's it like? Do you have good relationships with the kind of relevant Chinese officials? What's it like to work in Beijing compared to other places?
Very difficult. No, you don't have relations with relevant people. That's Chinese language. You don't have relations with if you're talking about government people. You really don't. Although I have to say, in the last year or so, since the foreign ministry's got a new spokesman. This is an example. For example, Liu Kang is the new spokesman at the foreign ministry. He's a very tough character. He's very good at what he does, but he understands better than his predecessors what we as Western reporters want and need, and so he'll consider requests. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't really see much point in talking to people at the foreign ministry because I know what they're going to say. But if I want to talk to, for example, the diplomat who's doing all this interesting negotiating in Myanmar, I can write to Liu Kang and say, I've just been in Myanmar, I'd like to talk to this guy, and he'll reply and say, I'll see what I can do. Now, that's a step forward to what we've had in the past. But a lot of it is... developing sources all over the place in different Chinese institutions, different Chinese companies, people from other countries. So it's a lot of piecing together, particularly in what I do. And on North Korea, for example, when you're trying to get an idea of what's going on between the two countries in the economy, you know, we went up to Shenyang, we talked to people up there, we immediately got followed by state security, we went up to Dandong, which is a couple of weeks later, to do some more reporting on the same issue. We immediately got followed by 5 police cars wherever we went. When we went to do an interview with a woman who's a manager of a garment manufacturing company that does work in North Korea on order from European companies. When we went to interview her, there were 5 state security people outside the pizza place. But we got the interview and she was very revealing. So you do what you can, is what I say.
Have you been arrested yet?
I've been not arrested. I've been stopped. I've been stopped at various places. Then a couple of weeks later, we went up to Jilin to find out some more on the same story, and they were waiting for us at the airport. So by this stage, we understood, okay, we're on some kind of alert list. And we went into the town from the airport, and we met with our first contact, who was actually the head of a rental agency, someone who I knew from before. And the state security people were outside the rental agency, and then they came into the rental agency to see that we were actually sitting in there. And then I realized we can't work here anymore because we were going to go and see somebody who was involved in business with North Korea, and if we went to see them, we'd be trailed by the state security people, so we had to bag it because we couldn't compromise that person. So that's three visits to three different cities in on the edge of North Korea on the Chinese side, and pretty difficult. But we got a story. It ended up on the front page of the New York Times. So there are lots of ways of doing it.
We're going to have to leave it there. There's so many, as somebody said, so many fascinating topics that we could get into. And with Jane's expertise and experience, we could spend days delving into them all. So unfortunately, we have to leave it here. Before I ask you to join me in thanking Jane, I just want to also mention that we've had confirmation on our 2017 Lowy lecture, which we're wildly excited about. We're getting the inimical Boris Johnson to be speaking to us, and that will be later on in July. So please check the website and get your tickets fast, because that would be something not to miss. Sorry to distract from the more important issue of China. So please, everyone, thanks again for coming out to the Lowy Institute today, and please join me in thanking Jane Perlez for joining us and for a fascinating conversation. Thank you.